Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. November 9th, 2025, episode 285. Lefty. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner, the Beekeeper's Corner. I'm Kevin England. I never get tired of the opening. Huey Lewis in the news. Love it, love it, love it. Mid-November. It's upon us, and at this time of year, I would imagine that most of you would be done with your fall preparations. And maybe like me, you're going to sneak out in the bee yard here and there to wrap up any punch list items that require last-minute attention. You did remember to slide all your inserts into your screen bottom boards, right? Before I get started, I wanted to take a moment to talk about the shoe. I'll share that I'm a bit off schedule. I recorded the content, at least several of these segments, a few weeks ago. But a situation got in the way prior to producing the show, and it's been shelved for a couple weeks. Alas, as they say, the show must go on. And I'm here now to plug it out, pick up where I left off. When you hear me refer to I did something yesterday or I did something Sunday, I'm not talking about today, November 9th. I was in that moment talking about 2 weeks ago with anticipation of releasing the shoe back then. It's just a footnote to consider, so when you're listening, the timing perspective is, well, put into perspective. As to the content of this episode, it's a mixed pass of different things. Roundtable number one, it's time. Time to get your fuel for the next season. And I'm talking about the habit of collecting pine needles. Roundtable number two, the insulation question. When do you do it? When do you put your insulation on your hives, if that's something you do? Roundtable number three, sleeping bees. Learn a little bit about what they look like. Number four, sometimes things are just part of the fabric of the operation. In this instance, small hive beetles. So far, at least here in the Mid-Atlantic region, they're just things we see. The question to ponder, though, is, are they emerging to become a menace? I wander and wonder out loud at some emerging noise I'm seeing about the growth of the problem. Roundtable number five, tropy on a boat. Maybe you saw this passing around. Maybe you didn't. Some good work was done to keep a possible tropy landlapse incursion on our shores. If it had come to pass, it would have worked out that New Jersey would have been ground zero if not for the good work of a team of people. Roundtable number six, crickets. A little factoid about them. I think you'll find it interesting, even though it's not about beekeeping. Feeding in the fall, that's the discussion point of roundtable number seven. And well, I had to share a cookie recipe for honey cookies, something I found on BeeSource. I'll have some reflections of the last bits of apiary work in the local hive report, and to close the show, I'll touch upon the lefty title that was assigned to the episode and talk a little bit about those delays I mentioned in the onset. Kevin@bkcorner.org is my email. Show notes are at www.bkcorner.org. Like and subscribe to the show. Leave a comment in your player to help us out. And a programming note to say, we have never used advertising for the show thus far. We pay all the fees out of pocket. But I'm not shy to say that a donation from our homepage doesn't hurt to defray the costs we've laid out to produce these shows over the 285 episodes. Let's go. Let's get to it. And thanks for tuning in to the show. Roundtable number one, it's time. If you know, you know that right now is the time. What time is it, you say? It is time to get your smoker fuel. There's a large pine tree right adjacent to the complex where I work. And I noticed pulling into work the other day, the entire parking lot was covered with dried, perfect for the smoker, pine needles. It's out there at that location in bushel quantities for the taking. And I also see, as I drive around, to and fro, several locations, and I have them cataloged in my brain, where the pine needles are always laying on the side of the streets. In places where it would be quite easy to pull over, load up, and do it without getting run over or run into. We all have them, don't we? You know, the places. The spots where we drive by and look in envy at all the free smoker fuel that's just ripe for the taking. As I think about it, this year, this stretch, this period when these needles are at their prime, it's been rather dry weather-wise. And you can find your needles laying on the road, sitting in the sun. And the unusual thing is they're usually free. You don't have to do anything but pick them up and put them right in your container. They're not loaded with leaves and stuff because the drifting winds blow the leaves away, but somehow it aggregates all the pine needles into nice little piles that you could just pick up and put in your vessel that you're carrying in your car. I have to say, there isn't much more that could bring a smile to a beekeeper's disposition. I go out at times with lawn and leaf bags and get my fill. And then I bring them home and stash them in a metal garbage can. Kevin moment. There is one thing that's kind of annoying. It's finding pine needles woven into the fabric of the carpets of your car, especially in the back where they have that really cheap carpet that covers the... Yeah, end of Kevin moment. What I do is I have a can dedicated to the task, and at various parts through the years when I need to reload, I wander over to the can and I offload a small little pile into a little kitchen garbage bag that I keep in my cart. I use that small bag of contents in the cart with the smoker to reload the smoker. And I can get about 8 to 10 sessions before I have to go back to the can in the garage to replenish the bag with more from the trash can repository. I also know that across the street from us, physically, there's pine trees next to the driveway. And if I'm really in a pinch, for some reason I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I'm at a loss for some, or even the pine trees out in front of the house, I can go collect them out of the grass or at the neighbor's driveway. I've actually asked the neighbors, hey, do you mind if I sweep these up? And they're like, you're going to clean this up for us? Sure, you can have all you want. So if you're in the need, simply peruse the neighborhood and look for some pine trees right along a side street. Start to make your catalog. You want ones that have a large swath of pavement for you to get in and get your fill and go to town. Roundtable number 2, insulation. I got this question this past week. When do you put insulation on your hives? The first question begs, do you need to insulate your hives? Technically, no. Honeybees will compensate for the weather situation in the United States and even in Canada, where they don't need to be insulated. But there's a lot of beekeepers who understand the benefits and the work done by beekeeping researchers to know that Langstroth boxes are a compromise. The thin substrate of the wood is kept at minimum for weight reasons and for commercial reasons, that is underpinning our design. And insulation-wise, they're not the greatest vessel to keep bees in. So if, as a caring beekeeper, you want to do a little bit more, it's not a complicated thing to strap on a little bit of insulation to improve the chances and operations of the bees during winter. We teach in our mentoring program the number one thing that all beekeepers should do 365 days a year is put 2 inches of foam insulation over top of the inner cover. Cut the foam the exact size of the inner cover and tuck it underneath the outer cover. It keeps heat from escaping out of the top of the hive, which is the primary heat loss area, and it also protects during the summer from excessive heat penetrating from the sun beating down on the top of the hive. But the question at hand is, if you want to go into more insulation around the perimeter of your hive, when's the time to do this? I actually have a very pragmatic answer to this. And first, let's consider the fact that hives don't really need to be insulated, so the timing of it is not as critical as you might think. I personally feel like number one objective for hive maintenance is to get the hive to winter state. Stepping back from insulation, you want to make sure your varroa mites are in check during the summer months so that you have healthy winter bees, and you want to make sure that your bees are well fed. The two primary objectives for winterization: 60 to 80 pounds in the mid-Atlantic region of capped honey in your colony, a large size colony of clean, non-parasitized bees. If you're in that state, you're there. There's nothing else to do from a manipulation maintenance standpoint. And ideally, you've taken care of all of this stuff through the summer months coming into fall so that you don't have to open your hives and do feeding and any inspections and things like that late in the season. Now, the only exception to that is if you decide to do a varroa mite treatment as the bees start to stop producing brood and they're broodless, you might do oxalic acid vaporizations to knock the mites down, so that the mites are low going into winter and especially coming out of spring. All of that said too, when you're done with all of that stuff, there's no reason to go in your hives. The days here, as I record this, in mid-October to late October, the days are 60, 65 degrees for a high, but 40s and some nights dipping into the 30s with first frost already happened in some areas of the zone. That means it's cold at night, and when it's below 45 degrees, generally the bees will come together and cluster. When they come together and cluster, they are performing an activity to conserve heat and share heat, and any heat that resides in the box around the bees being maintained means less work for them at night, less food to eat, and things like that. So when you see nights that are persistently lower than 45 degrees, coupled with the premise that you finished all of your maintenance activities and you don't need to open your hives anymore, it's a good idea to put your insulation on. It doesn't hurt. It might be a little bit too early when the hives are 70 degrees. Some beekeepers will argue that they like when it's 60 to 70 degrees. And by the way, on Sunday this week, it was 75. That with the insulation, it prevents the heat from penetrating in when the sun is shining on the hives. But you have to find some sort of balance or trade-off. If you put your insulation on, would that heat get into the hive? No. It's going to prevent it from penetrating through. This is where I say you do you. I think when the leaves turn and it gets cool and you're thinking about throwing that extra quilt on your bed at night, that's about the time that you want to, it's a not very scientific answer, I know, put the insulation on your hives. When you're ready to throw it, at least a long sleeve shirt and a light jacket on when you're going outside. When you go outside at night and you go, there's a chill in the air, not a bad idea. Scientifically, what I would say is when you're done with your hive manipulations to the point where you're not going to open the hives, it's a good idea. And I generally tell people rule of thumb is Halloween. October 31st is a good time frame to think about it. Is it the right answer? Maybe. I think it's a logical answer. As to what kind of insulation, I think at this point, the 2-inch foam blocks that you cut out and fit around your colony are a great idea. If you want to go a little simpler, you can buy a Bee Cozy from the catalogs. They're like a thin blanket that you slide down around. Sometimes people use Reflectex or other gear. Yeah, I don't know. And if you really want to know, look at the researcher information from Etienne Tardif and John Gott and Bill Hesbeck. They're three pioneers in telling you the science behind insulating and moisture and upper entrances and things like that. If you're really interested, now's the time to dig in on that if you're trying to make a plan. But if you have your insulation and you're just wondering simply when to turn it on, when to put it on, I would say sometime in late October, first weeks of November. One other thing that I would say is bees are building propolis. I noticed going in the hives this weekend that the hives are pretty much sealed. As I crack through, it's quite a chore to break the inner cover off. And when propolis stiffens in cooler weather, it's hard to break through the propolis seals. That also equates to it's not warm enough and it's difficult for the bees to fix the propolis seals. So if you don't need to go into a hive this time of year, and you're not trying to break the propolis seals, and they're basically going to be sealed up, see you in spring, then why not put insulation on? If they're in generating heat, it's going to be a benefit for them. A long way around to a short answer, Halloween. That's the time frame that I would suggest that if you're trying to figure out when to put in, that's my rule of thumb and what we tell our beekeepers. Roundtable number two. Call this one Sorry Girls. Late this summer, we harvested a few spare frames of honey that were in honey boxes here and there around the yard as we were taking them off getting ready for winter. When one of those was done, to clean it out, I took and placed it on the satellite hive for the bees to pull down any excess honey. Satellite hive, Kevin moment. It's an odd thing calling it that. I forget that I use this name now and again and think nothing of it, and I wonder if the listeners ever postulate why I call it that. Eons ago, my in-laws owned our house and subscribed to satellite TV, way in the beginning. And over in the side yard, my father-in-law constructed a large concrete pad and installed one of those old-fashioned satellite dishes, you know, the ones that were about 8 foot across. I don't know what this says about me, but it's still there. I never took it down. And one day, I'll get over there and figure out how to dismantle it and recycle it for metal, for scrap. End of Kevin moment. Now to the point, I put a beehive or two over there next to the satellite pad at one point, and now you know why I call them the satellite hives. Coming back to center, part of my winter machinations this week, I noticed that I forgot to pull that spent honey super off of that hive. And I took it off as part of my final winterization checklist. I'm ensuring that I didn't miss compacting all my hives down to the size of the colony and placing on entrance reducers. When I opened that hive to take the box off, I took a moment. Notice there wasn't much going on in that top box, but I did see some sleeping bees. And I felt bad in that moment, disturbing their slumber. The thing I wanted to take a moment to reflect on here and now is my statement, sleeping bees. How do I know they're sleeping? How could I tell? If you know, you know. Sleeping bees, they have a certain look. And if you ever take the moment to consider the situation, the shoe fits. It was mid-afternoon. I pulled the inner cover off, and there were some errant bees in the outer frames. Frames, let's say 1 through 4 or 6 through 10, the outer part. They were quiescent and presented in one of two ways. They looked still, standing on the comb. Or there were a cluster of cells with abdomens sticking out. The bees are still in a manner that's a little uncanny. If you just look and don't touch the hive, they don't move. They look frozen in time. I think you probably know that it's not unusual to see bees moving. Moving, moving, moving. They're constantly on the move. And when they are still, and for long periods of time, they're not pondering the mysteries of the universe. They're either resting or they're sleeping. It's one or the other. Resting, sleeping, or move, 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 move. And there's a difference between a resting bee and a sleeping bee. Resting bees will pause, and then within a 50 count, they'll move. They'll move a touch. They'll move in some manner. They might take a few steps. They might turn around and become quiet again. They're just stopped for a moment in pause, but they're not sleeping. And, you know, one of the key things to look at when you're looking for a sleeping bee is the abdomen. What is it doing? A sleeping bee in a cell. Let's go with that one. Instead of one standing on the honeycomb, it's easier to see this. Think about the visual clues to distinguish the behavior. Why do bees go into the cells? They go in to clean them. They go in to heat them, and they go in to sleep. Cleaning bees, in and out, easy to tell. In and out, doing something, move, move, move. Heater bees are a little more complicated because they stay resident in the cell, and they don't move too much. But make no mistake, they're working hard. They're moving their flight muscles, and that expends a lot of energy, and therefore they need to breathe constantly. And so, while they look quiet and they don't move, if you look at the abdomen, it's in and out all the time. If it's not clear, a breathing bee moves their abdomen in and out like an accordion. And a heater bee in a cell, you will see the tip of the abdomen coming in and out while they laboriously look to create heat. Now, there's another part of this going back to my observation. What time of day is it? Late in the day. Where are the bees? Up in the top quiet part of the hive where there's not a lot of activity. And what are they doing? They're just hanging out. They either have nothing to do, they're idle, which is not very common in a beehive, or they're resting, sleeping. So let's come back to the sleeping bee. The one in the cell. It doesn't move. You'll see very, very, very little activity. They'll be still for a period of time that you wonder if they're even alive. But of course, as a living entity, they need to breathe. So if you look closely, every once in a while, you see they'll take a couple quick breaths, and then it'll stop again. That's a sleeping bee. Now, coming back to, do they always sleep in the cells? They don't. Sometimes they sleep standing on the comb. When you see these bees, they're locked onto the cell. They have like what I would describe, and it's not accurate, but it's visual, a death grip on the comb. You could tap them and they wouldn't move. They won't fall off. They're locked on. But every once in a while, you see the slightest movement from their abdomen. Again, timing-wise, I was in the hive late in the day, mid-afternoon. And it's probably the girls that got an early start, worked all morning, and now in the early afternoon packed it in for the day or are taking a break before they go do their afternoon flights when I came to do my manipulations. When you know this, you kind of feel bad disturbing them. If you've ever pulled a frame with bees sleeping on it, you'll notice they react, at least by my observation, in a couple different ways. Some of them actually stay frozen to the cell. They just keep sleeping. Even if you're moving it around, doing whatever, they're locked on. Others wake up like the jig is up. They start to move. They dash for a second. They get a read on the situation. And then they do, I guess, whatever comes to mind. Some stop and stay put. Some go into a cell. Some fly off the comb, go back to the hive. I often tell our students in the mentoring program, before you pull a frame, just put a little smoke in the hive to get the guards off guard and watch the bees on the frame, especially on the top of the hive. You'll see this, I guarantee it. Now, as to the activity I was performing, I felt cruel, disturbing their slumber. I actually picked the box off, which only had maybe 100 bees in it, and I tapped it down into the grass to dislodge all the bees. I physically held the box by both handles on the long end, and I gave it a quick bang down on the ground, and it knocks all the bees, breaks their grip, and they fall down between the seams and end up in the grass. I think about the bees, they were sleeping one moment, and they're in the grass the next thing, going, what the heck is going on? In the span of 2 minutes, while I finished doing what I was doing, the sun was beating down on that patch of ground. They took to flying, and they flew the 3 feet to the front entrance and went back into the hive, probably crawled back up into the top to find some quiet, dark place, and try and get a few more Z's after their rough awakening in the midday. If you want to know more about the sleeping habits of bees, check the show notes. I'll have a link there to a research article entitled Slumber in a Cell, Honeycomb Used by Honeybees for Food, Brood, Heating, and Sleeping. It outlines quite a bit about the sleeping habits and behaviors of honeybees, and it's a fascinating read. Roundtable number 4, The New Menace. Last year I was asked to give a talk about small hive beetles for the Long Island Beekeeping Club. I thought originally when they contacted me, maybe they were just looking for a different topic to cover and educate their beekeepers on. But the fact of the matter is, they actually had several stories of beekeepers being impacted and overrun by small hive beetles. I don't know what to make of that. Is it a one-off situation? Were the conditions right? Did something unusual occur where small hive beetles thrived in that area through that region? When you hear different stories that seem odd like that, it makes you tune in. Could that happen here? I personally see small hive beetles every year. In fact, I mashed a bunch of them yesterday while doing some feeding activity. But I've never lost a hive to them. And in this region, the Mid-Atlantic, it's not usual to hear people say they've lost hives to small hive beetles. If you keep a decent-sized colony in a compact arrangement, they typically keep things at bay. It's usually the fringe things that occur that could lead to a small hive beetle. A queen gone bad or two colonies combined in a lot of extra space, things like that. But now that my antenna is up, I tune in to different encounters that I come across from beekeepers that I talk to, stuff I see reported on, and different things that pop up in my social media conversations. And I'm not sure if it's because I'm paying attention, but there's a trend. Keeps showing up evidence that small hive beetle impacts seem to be on the rise. And while this may not be ringing alarm bells, I've noticed that when they seem to surface, it's in areas, pockets, where they do actually have quite a challenge on their hands. It seems to be more impactful. Case in point, a social media post recently lamented about the labor required by the commercial beekeepers who never had to deal with small hive beetles. And when I started keeping bees, we didn't have them. They've migrated into our region and now they're a fixture. Down south, they have them. And not only do they have them in ways that challenge them. They used to do some proactive measures. And what I'm reading is now it's considered a laborious task where they have to manage small hive beetles as much as they manage, say, Varroa mites. That's a heck of a burden for a commercial organization. And it trickles over to all of the hobbyist beekeepers in those zones, too. And maybe that's why this is becoming more frequently discussed and reported on. The topic generates a number of comments and feedback every time I see people talking about it. Originally, there'd be onesie, twosie comments because people weren't that interested. But now, whenever someone's talking about it, there's a litany of comments and feedback and suggestions and reports of, I had this happen too. One particular share that I read recently, a commercial person said something about how they used to get a break at the end of the season, but now they have a massive amount of work to protect their equipment from small hive beetles, and all of the commercial brethren piled on saying what a burden it is and all of the things they have to do in order to keep things at bay and countermeasures. And coming back to locally, the Mid-Atlantic region, it makes me wonder one question. Is this critical mass? We don't have too much experience with overtakes, but case in point in Long Island, it's not out of the question. I think the real danger zone lies in the space below Maryland and south, and we're fortunate that our soils and climate abate massive takeovers. But what if something changes and this trend escalates? I feel like the door is open to be on the fringe of seeing more routine infestations, and I personally don't want to be blindsided by it. So I'm watching, listening, learning. If you want to keep things in check, and scrupulous beekeepers do, I don't particularly mind seeing small hive beetles. I know it. Let's just talk about this. Small hive beetles in your hives require a certain number of bees to keep them in check. They make small hive beetle jails. They chase them around. They have to monitor and keep them up in the top of the hive and all of that stuff. If you don't have them, those bees doing that job could be doing other things on behalf of your colony. And so you can deploy traps and Swiffer sheets and diatomaceous earth down on the ground. There's all kinds of things that you could do. The number one thing is keep strong hives and never leave a lot of open space. So let's say you have 2 weak colonies and for whatever reason you decide to combine them and they occupy half the space of the two boxes you put together, that's a bastion for small hive beetles this time of year. So the best defense is a strong hive in a compact space. Now, it's not my intent to go into a small hive beetle protection situation, more to ask out loud, are they becoming more of a pest than in the past, or is the ramp for that to happen there? I don't know. My true fear is if a menace emerges and we start losing hives to small hive beetles, boy, that's going to be just one more straw on the camel's back. Now, I'm not being an alarmist. I don't think this is going to happen yet. But I'm going to keep my ears open, and see if I start hearing more and more people dealing with this. And this is the funny thing. In this day and age, if someone loses a hive to small hive beetles, the old codgers of the world will blame it on the beekeeper. You know, a colony lost to small hive beetles is a colony that was lost because of beekeeper inattentiveness. And that can be true. My notion, though, leads me to wonder where there will come a day when even strong colonies will succumb to small hive beetle tactics, and that true menace will be born. And you only need to look at what's going on down south to hear people say, well, no, I had a full strong colony. I had traps in place. I reduced the entrance and this and that, and still the small hive beetles destroyed the hive. It sure seems the potential is there. And it wouldn't take, and this is the scary part, that much of a tactic change for the small hive beetle to gain the upper hand. Right? Why can't the small hive beetles figure out a better way? They are going to evolve, and there might be a time when they figure out how to overwhelm the defenses of a regular colony. Now, bees win almost 99% of the time, based on what I see. But there might come a day when they have a good fight on their hands. And you know, if I were a beekeeper researcher, younger person with great aspirations, this might be an interesting dynamic to tune into, a model. Yeah. Kevin Moman, I have a silent notion for wanting to pay attention. Someday down the road, Sharon and I talked about relocating out of New Jersey. And we've entertained going to New York, Maryland. We've looked in North Carolina, West Virginia, Tennessee. No particular order. But it's not lost on me that some of those places are small hive beetle territory. And so paying attention is something I personally have an interest in keeping an eye on. End of Kevin Moment. Now look, I can't profess that we're in peril anytime soon, but I do believe that we all should be paying attention. And I have to say to those who are in hot spots for small hive beetles, I really feel for you. There are few things in beekeeping that are more disgusting than cleaning up after a small hive beetle infestation. You lose your resources, you deal with slime out, and there's no redeeming qualities for the situation. It truly is gross and a heartbreaking experience. Here's to hoping the status quo of it being a minor pest to honeybees, at least in our region, remains the same. Roundtable number 5, I call this one, and now you know. This week, a message was circulated on the letterhead of the New Jersey Department of Agriculture stating that the NJDEP, in coordination with the USDA and multiple other agencies, thwarted a potential incursion of tropi laylaps this past summer. Yeah, maybe I should have called this one tropi on a boat. During the New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting held June 6th, 7th, something like that, this year I spent a few minutes on the side, catching up with state apiarist Megan McConnell. We discussed a bunch of different topics about the New Jersey beekeeping scene, and one of the breaking moments in that conversation that we were having is the situation that was actively going on offshore, where a colony of Apis dorsata bees were found on a container ship coming into the port of Newark. Megan said, at that moment, like the night before apparently, they were able to eradicate the bees before the ship got into port. And she went on further to elaborate that they had taken samples of the bees and sent them out for testing to determine whether they were hosting the insidious tropi laylaps mites, which, of course, we would like to hold off from having in the U.S. for as long as possible. During that moment, they were having the discussion about those bees, and specifically the correlation of where the ship was coming from. And given its port of origin, there was the potential, they knew it at that time, of tropi laylaps in that colony. And they stopped the ship, they stopped it from coming in, killed all the bees, and the situation was mitigated. What was reported was the swarm of bees was just that, a swarm in a cluster, hanging on, I presume, a container. Who knows what it really looked like. There was no brood and there was no comb present, so it wasn't like somebody was transporting a colony. Still, you know, to be safe, they eradicated the entire population and chose to freeze them on the ship and send them for examination to determine whether or not they were hosting Tropilelops, because the ship had been in India where the bees do cohabitate with tropi mites. As it turns out, good speculation. They did find Tropilelops mites on the bees. And one considered this was a fortuitous catch in stopping this colony from entering our shores. From the letter that is circulating in social media these days, they found two types of mites on these bees, and credit was passed around for the agencies involved, and appreciation was given to the cargo ship crew for working with the U.S. agencies to conduct the job. You know, in my way of thinking, there's probably somebody forgotten in this whole thing, which is the unknown worker who spotted this swarm and took the moment to inform the ship's crew to the point where the situation was identified in the first place for mitigation. What's ironic is probably that person had no idea the importance of what they did, and given their perspective and the crew's perspective, they simply just didn't want to have an encounter with a cluster of bees. It's one of those butterfly flaps its wings moments. In the end, all's good, that ends well, and nice job to Megan and the others who were principal in resolving the situation. Outstanding work done by the whole crew. Roundtable number 6, crickets. As a beekeeper, you become, obviously, infatuated with bees. But eventually you broaden your horizon because you get asked about all other kinds of insects, especially Hymenoptera and other wasps and bumblebees and so on and so on. People see you as a bug expert. And so now I'm going to share one with you about crickets. Have you ever heard of a cricket thermometer? Did you know that crickets could be used to gauge what the temperature is outside? It comes from the fact that crickets are ectothermic, meaning their body temperature depends on the environment. And as it turns out, the number of chirps that the cricket issues is tied to the weather. And this is the rule of thumb that you might find in a farmer's almanac. During the time of a 15-second window, count the number of chirps. Let's say it's 30 chirps in 15 seconds. Then you add the number 40 to it, and you'll find that the temperature outside is 70 degrees. Now, you know, all these silly little things that you see, is it really true? Could it work? Why would it make sense? Actually, this is apparently fairly accurate. And the funny thing is, there's certain kinds of crickets that are spot on. It is said that the snowy tree cricket is nicknamed the thermometer cricket for its accuracy. I bring this up because lately, as it is in the fall, there always tends to be a cricket, either inside my room where I'm sitting or right outside the window. And it's like cricket in Times Square. It just goes off and off. And they hide in a little nook or cranny, or you can't see them. They're impossible to find, and so you just have to endure that. And with my new hearing aids, it makes it even more pleasurable. But that being said, count the chirps in 15 seconds, and then add 40 to it, and you should generally get the sense of what the temperature is outside. Now, this isn't foolproof. Not all crickets are the same. And the other thing is, maybe the cricket's tucked in next to your foundation where it's a little bit warmer, and so it's going to skew its ability to chirp at the right rate. Ideally, the cricket would be out in the field somewhere, experiencing the real temperature and tell you what's going on. It's more of a fun estimation tool than a precise forecast method. There is apparently a way to convert the cricket chirps to Celsius if you're one of those. 48 chirps divided by 3 and then you add 4 to it. So count the chirps in 25 seconds, divide it by 3, and then add the number 4, and that'll give you the Celsius translation. That's kind of fun. Little fact to share, and I think kids would love that. So maybe this fall, while you're out on a romp looking at the leaves, and you hear a cricket, take a moment and see if the cricket thermometer works for you. Round table number 7, feeding in fall. I received an email from a beekeeper who found themselves in an unusual situation. And they're facing emergency feeding here in the fall, which is something you don't usually get yourself into. The situation broke down this way. They had 2 deeps and a medium over top. A full-size, robust colony with a full honey super over top. They had 2 hives in the same condition. If you think about the way New Jersey was this year, food supply for the bees. Food-wise, there wasn't much in the spring. Terrible nectar flow, worst we've had in many, 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 many years. We did have a dearth during August time frame into September. There was a reasonable goldenrod flow, but apparently when they went in to take the honey supers off to come back the hive down to 2 deeps for winter, they found the bees cleaned out the honey super, and there was no storage in the brood boxes. In a typical scenario, the answer would be feed, feed, feed. Get them fat and happy. But when you find that situation towards the latter stages of October, you have to kind of look at the forecast out and say, how do you compensate for this? The answer is it's not an interesting place to be in. You have to figure out something, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks. The obvious solution would be feed liquid 2-to-1, or maybe even 3-part sugar to 1-part water. The way you feed bees in late summer and early fall is a concentrated sugar solution, and as they take it down from your feeder, they mix it with enzymes and they break it down with invertase, store it in the cell, and dry it out. You have to assess their ability to be able to do that at this time of year. If we look at the forecast out for the next 2 weeks, you're looking at high temperatures of 55 and low temperatures of 45, 240, and some in the 30s. Can the bees operate at 55 degrees? The answer is yes, but you have to take that with a grain of salt. Because the fact that in the morning, when the sun rises, the temps are in the 40s. At 45, they're all huddled together. It's the general rule of thumb. They're not working and operational. They're going to wait until mid-morning before the hive warms up. They could break cluster and go do work. They're going to be able to operate through to maybe mid-afternoon. And then they're going to have to come back together because as the sun starts to set, it chills. That's not a large window of work time. In that time, they have to pull that liquid down, convert it, store it, and dry it. Evaporation at this time of year, not the greatest principle for the bees. And so their ability to convert whatever you feed them into 60 to 80 pounds, it's just running out. And additionally, what happens is as they have wet storage inside the brood chamber, alongside the brood chamber, above the brood chamber, it changes the envelope inside. It's moister because there's water in there. Fast forward to winter, if they were eating that, the excess moisture, when they're trying to be in torpor and they're taking in additional liquids, means they probably have to have more cleansing flights. And it's going to be cold, and it's going to put stress and duress on the bees. So the principle of feeding should be done by October 31st, which is this week, not feed. So how do you compensate for this, especially if a colony is bone dry? One option would be buy your bag of sugar, 5 pounds. Now I think they sell them in 4 pound bags. Put it in a huge bowl and sprinkle water on it and mix it until it resembles like a coarse sand. You can go out to your colony and pull frames 1, 2, maybe even 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, anything the bees are not occupying, and rub this sugar mixture into the cells. There are times when you get to spring, if you've done beekeeping enough that you've seen this, if you fed wet liquid to the bees and it's dried out over winter but they didn't eat it, and or they found some sort of nectar flow late but they didn't get to ripen it, you'll see dried crystals in the cells. Bees can use that, but it's not converted and ready to eat for them to be food. So this is not the greatest idea, but if they have nothing, something is better than nothing. In addition to this, you could make fondant and cook it down and break the sugars, making it a little more edible for the bees, and then place the fondant over the hive. But to have a full-size colony on empty frames with nothing but fondant, that too is a slippery slope. Some beekeepers make candy boards. You take a rimmed, almost like an inner cover, and cook candy and pour it through. There's recipes out on the internet. A combination of these things would be really the only choice this person has, by my estimation. I can't think of, you know, obviously, if you had other hives that had excess honey, you could steal a frame or two and put them in there. But I wouldn't take good honey away from a colony that set itself up and put them at risk by stealing their stores to prop up a colony that doesn't have anything. It's a difficult situation to be in. And the lesson learned here is you have to feed in August and September and be done feeding by mid-October is the general rule of thumb. I am breaking that rule this year. I'm looking at the weather and I think you can get one more installment in. And I'd like to see my bees have a little bit more. So on Monday, I am going to pour my last gallons of 2-to-1 sugar. And the reason I think I can get away with this is I saw a colony that was not fed by me, but fed by nature, and they still have some unripened honey in their entire top box. They're close. They're about to finish it. That tells me that from a nature standpoint, they're still working on it. And if I give them some 2-to-1, or it's actually mixed a little thicker than that, maybe they could pull this down. Will they have a little bit wet syrup possibly in these hives? Yes, but I think they can get the job done. As I look at the forecast out through the rest of November, it looks like it's going to stay 55-ish through to the middle based on the long-term forecasts. If I saw that the temperatures would be down in the low 50s and 40s as a high come mid-November, end of November, I wouldn't do this. And even then, I'm pushing the envelope. So from that perspective, feeding in fall. Feeding in fall is a summer activity. It really is. You should be doing it in August and September. And when the leaves change, you should be wrapping it up. And when the leaves are down on the ground here, which they are piling up in the yard, you should be done and the bees should be drying that stuff out with their final runs. I hope this beekeeper does okay. I think they're going to try the sandy sugar method. And they're going to build fondant and do some of the other things that's there. It's a funny thing, and I say this, I've been caught off guard thinking, yeah, there's honey on top, they'll do fine. And then you go find out it's gone. Sometimes these colonies get robbed. And then something comes in and steals all their stores too late in the fall. They don't defend themselves or something happens in that capacity. So you really do have to do your fall inspections. It's typical, and I don't know why, for beekeepers occasionally to get a little complacent in the summer months. Go on vacation and you come back and you go, they're okay. They've been okay. They were great last time I looked at them. I'm sure they're fine. And then you find yourself surprised. And it's important in that fall time period to be looking in after the bees to make sure you don't get caught off guard. Feeding in fall, it's an interesting, it's kind of one of those cerebral things that you have to kind of pay attention to and come up with a really good plan. Roundtable number 8. It's fall, and fall deserves fall things. I'm talking about molasses cookies, or in this case, honey cookies. I was bopping around BeeSource the other day and found this recipe from David Lewis. It was a family recipe for molasses cookies. And they're the typical molasses cookies that you cook. They bake up puffy, and then when they cool off, they sink and they have that crinkled appearance on the top. You know, you think about fall and you have those fall flavors of cloves and cinnamon and ginger, and these cookies fit the bill. Went to Eastern States, Middletown, New York, the Orange County Fairgrounds, for the Eastern States 200. As a race fan, this race is historic. It's one of the longest running 200 lap races in the country. I think it might actually be the one. And as a kid, it was a really big deal. The who's who of racers in the dirt modified area went to that race. And they still have the race. It's lost a little bit of its luster. The racetrack isn't as nice as it was in its heyday. But we went, and one of the things you do is they have a unique feature, which is a drive-in. You drive your car in the back and park it and sit in the car and watch the races from your automobile. And we do like doing that. We didn't do it as kids. We always sat in the grandstands. But when you sit in the car, it's kind of like a picnic atmosphere. You bring yourself a sandwich and you maybe have an adult beverage and have some treats. So I baked up a batch of David Lewis's cookies that I found on BeeSource. But here's the wrinkle to this. They were molasses cookies, and his little twist on it was one time he ran out of molasses, so he substitute honey for the molasses part, and they become honey cookies. I thought this is an interesting choice. I like molasses cookies. If you know the gingerbread molasses cookies, they have that soft chew to them and the ginger taste, which is really appealing. I wondered how it would translate if you swapped out the honey. This is the recipe. 3/4 cup shortening, and you want to heat that in a microwave or heat it in a pan until it's liquefied, according to his directions. You mix that with 1 cup of sugar, and then you mix in 1/4 cup of molasses in the original recipe, or swap it out for some dark honey if you have dark is better, 1 large egg, and stir that all together until it becomes a slurry. In a separate bowl, you sift 2 cups of flour, 1/2 teaspoon of ground cloves, 1/2 teaspoon of ground ginger, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. After you mix your dry ingredients, you spoon them in to the wet ingredients and mix it until it's combined. You're going to take that dough and put it in the fridge. At least for 1/2 hour, it says, but I left it in overnight. And then you're going to spoon it out into 1-inch balls and bake them on a greased cookie sheet. 350 degrees And in our oven, it was 11 minutes. It was like 10 minutes and 30 seconds, and they were perfect. 12 minutes, and they were a little too dark. We had one round that went farther than they should have, but they were still really good. Before you bake them, you take the ball and you roll it in sugar. And what happens is the cookies melt down into a dome. And then when you take them out, leave them on the pan for at least 10 minutes and they'll cool and flatten and they'll be rigid enough that you can scoop them out and put them onto a wired baking sheet. What I gave you, the ingredient list, turned out to be 25 cookies. They were amazing right out of the oven, and they were just as good sitting looking through the windshield at Alex Yankowski win the Eastern States 200 in 2025. I got the recipe from B-Source. Look, from molasses cookies to honey cookies is the title of it, and I'll have a link in the episode for the recipe. A local Hive report this weekend, and now I'm in the real time recording this because I'm on Sunday, November 9th. It's the final in the apiary weekend around here. Nothing left to do now but check in on the hives periodically until spring knocks on the door. I spent the last couple apiary days over the previous weekends going hive by hive and making sure that everything was set up the way it should be going into winter. I've had feeders on my hive since mid-August, and over the last 2 weeks I went through and pulled them all off and closed up the hives. And one thing that I did was make sure that there was insulation over every single inner cover. I've said this over and over again, I think one of the most important things for winter is to have a 2-inch foam insulation cap over every inner cover. And I do that for every wooden hive I have, including my nucleus colonies. Of course, I don't have to do that for the polystyrene hives. They're just set up. In addition, I completed the customary checklist to ensure the entrances are closed well, that all the boxes are sealed and aligned, and that I did not miss closing any of the screen bottom boards. You know, I had originally planned to plant some grass in my main apiary this year in the early November, late October, early November, but due to my lefty situation, which I'll talk about in the closing, that got derailed, and I'm not sure if the next couple weekends will possibly give me the chance to get that done before the ground freezes. I really would love to see some grass grow in the apiary and try it one more time. We'll see what things bring. As to the conditions of the hives, I have to say it's not my best effort. I feel like the hives could have been provisioned a little bit better this year. I would have loved to have made them more fat and happy with food stores. And it's definitely a case where more hives, in my situation, does not make things better in the context of my ability to care for them in the manner that they need. I think I just have too many hives for the time I have available to go out and do things, and with my busy lifestyle. I love having a lot of hives, though. I don't know, there's just something about that. I wish I could find a way to make that work. As it is, some of the hives that I talk about aren't really hives. They're playthings. The Waray hive, it's not going to make it through. It just doesn't have enough bees. I've looked at the Layens hive. It's messa messa. I don't know that I have enough bees in there. And I've really left them to their own devices. I haven't treated them this year. And well, when I look across at the other ones, the couple small nukes that I have, they aren't the strongest going into winter. But, you know, on the flip side, I do believe that there's enough strong hives that whatever makes it through, I'm positive that I can replenish any losses in the spring and bring the operation up to full song when it comes to that time of splitting hives for swarm prevention in the spring to rebuild the numbers for whatever is called for. I do reserve the notion to possibly put some insulation Around at least two of the nucleus colonies that are residing in wooden boxes this year over the next 2 weeks or so. I decided to try that, meaning overwinter in wooden nukes again. Because, well, I'm using most of my polystyrene nuke hive equipment in the playground apiary for the queens that I reared. And so, being out of that type of equipment, I had to fall back to the wooden stuff that I had in reserve. I think when you try to overwinter a winter nuke, one, push them together, I have them on separate stands, and two, insulate them. You might as well give them every advantage you can. The other thing that I have left on my to-do list is an oxalic acid vaporization treatment of the hives in the next couple of weeks. I've had this poetic notion that it should be done around the Thanksgiving time frame. We heard from Robin Underwood at HiveMind that bees are mostly broodless by now. She was talking about an experiment where she and some others are purposely going to open hives every week, I think she said, every couple of weeks. I have to go back and look at the notes on that. Because they want to know if bees are rearing brood at this time of year and through the stretch. She physically goes through every single frame in examination looking for brood patterns. Her summation is that the queens basically have shut down by now, and that there would be little to no brood in the colonies in the Mid-Atlantic region. That means it's an ideal time frame, to do oxalic acid vaporizations. You want to get some of those days where the temperature happens to be above 45, 50 degrees. Maybe gets to 60 in the afternoon and the bees do cleansing flights. That means they're going to break cluster a little bit and your oxalic acid vaporizations will get to more bees. I would bet that I'll talk about that more in an upcoming episode. Now, while the outside work has pretty much come to a close, the season's not over yet, as November often signals that you got to get to whatever spring preparations you could do now. While the temperatures outside are still comfortable enough to get things organized in the garage. Maybe you got to put a shacket on, a flannel or something, go out there with a ball cap and some light gloves. And mend equipment that needs mending and prep stuff that needs prepping for spring. Get all that stuff done as much as possible before it gets too cold to the point where you can't work in your workspace. Although that too is somewhat done for my operation. I've done a little bit of that already, but there's some work to do there. You know, really, as this part of the year descends upon us and it's dark at 5 p.m. due to daylight savings time, I find that I start to shift gears towards the other part of my life for beekeeping, which is creating content for training or learning things or planning for next spring or doing those winter projects like making candles and lip balm and stuff like that. In that perspective, from November, December, January, February, I've already started to plan the work so I could work the plan. In reflection, it's been a fun year for beekeeping. In my quasi-retired oddball state that I'm in right now, being home all the time, I think I've done a reasonable job at looking at the bees and taking care of them. When I look at the goals that I set forth for this season, I've accomplished most of what I wanted to try, and for the most part, things worked out pretty well. It seems to me that making plans for the 2026 beekeeping season is right around the corner. I'm curious to see, come spring, how that operation worked out where I pulled all the brood that was capped and centered it in one hive impacts how the bees survived in spring. That'll be an interesting thing to watch. Local hive report, check. Time to close down the episode. I've been hinting at this through the show that once again I've suffered a little bit of a setback in my ability to do things. I mentioned that we went to Eastern States, the 200 lapper at the Orange County Fair Speedway. Well, we had a good time that day. I was absolutely miserable with pain in my right wrist. It just occurred out of the blue, and I wondered whether I had injured my arm in some way while working on some aspects of remodeling our house. The pain was so extreme that Sunday night that I felt like I broke my wrist. On Monday, we were able to get in and see an orthopedic doctor who preliminarily diagnosed me with an onset of gout. I left his office in disbelief, but he put me on a regimen to take away the gout symptoms and said, come back on Friday if it doesn't improve. I returned on Friday to his office with my arm inflamed and a rather sour disposition as to the pain that I endured during the entire week walking around with my arm swollen from my fingertips to my elbow. The doctor suggested maybe some sort of infection had formed in the joint and stuck a needle in there to see if he could draw out any pus. That didn't appear to be what was going on, as he didn't get anything out of it. Given the diagnosis didn't appear to be right, they sent me for blood tests and MRI. In the end, the blood test showed, as my boss cheekily said to me this week, there is no gout. They ruled it out without a doubt. But instead, there was a likelihood that it was Lyme's disease. You know, when you're a beekeeper out in the fields all the time doing things, this comes with the territory. Incidentally, the doctor dismissed the MRI technician who wrote this huge report that there was fraying and straining of the ligaments. And I want to believe that he thought that that stuff that turned up in the MRI, the injury to my wrist, was not a result of the remodeling stuff and any injuries there, but just normal wear and tear on my old body. I should mention that when I came back for an additional visit, the original doctor was out for the week and a second doctor was in to look at the outcome of whatever was going on. After the MRI and the blood test, they put me on an antibiotic and an anti-inflammatory, and I'm happy to report as of the current time, the functionality of my hand has come back to about 70%. I could mostly use it to do some tasks, but I don't yet have the strength in it, and it's still painful when I try to make a fist or squeeze, push, pull, anything. I'm supposed to go see a specialist about Lyme's disease, and I'm lined up to go get some physical therapy to ensure that I can get all of the functionality back in my hand. The pain over the first 2 weeks of this condition was something that I think beekeepers could probably associate with. You know, when you're a new beekeeper and you take a sting on the arm, it often occurs if you have a bit of an allergy that your arm is swollen from your fingertips to your elbow. You can't bend your fingers, your hand is puffed up all the way, and everything feels like a hot poker sticking through your wrist. If you've ever experienced that, you know that sleeping and just plain trying to hold your arm in some manner where it was comfortable becomes a difficult chore. And I was in that state for a week or two. I really have to say at this point that I'm glad the arm has responded to the medications. The swelling's gone. Most of the stiffness is gone. I can bend my fingers. The medicines that they've given me recently have sorted a lot of that out. As it was, in the middle of all that, I presented at the Hive Mind Symposium. With my arm held across my chest the entire time I did my talk. And I was riding some oxy, I have to say. Oxycodone, because my arm was spazzing about 20 minutes before I was set to go on stage. I'm not really sure that anyone noticed. And honestly, the oxy just dulls the pain a little bit. It didn't make me goofy, I don't think. Nobody said anything to me, and I don't believe anybody was none the wiser, other than they could see here and there that I was in a little bit of a pain. You know, I'll talk about the Northwest Hive Mind Symposium in the next show, as I want to give a full recap of how it went. I have to say, in passing though, they did a spectacular job, and I explicitly want to reserve a full segment for that next time. So now you know a little of the backstory of why the show's been kind of on hold for a couple weeks. It feels like this pattern of some difficulty emerges periodically. It's not lost on me that this time last year I fell off a ladder and injured my back and went through the period of recovery. All I have to say is, it's heck. H-E double hockey sticks to get old. And for you young folks, enjoy your health. And for those of you who are in my genre, do all that you can to keep yourself fit and healthy. That's all that's fit to print for this show. I can't think of anything else. I have a bunch of stuff to bring up in the next episode, and I have a cool interview coming up that I'm really excited to get to. So I guess it's time to say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, they can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody. Be well, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Beekeeper's Corner.